This is Jordan, and you're listening to the Code 7 Podcast Network.
Warning. This episode contains the three A's of podcasting: adult content, adult language, and awesomeness. You've been warned.
Welcome to Within the Trenches, true stories from the 911 dispatchers who live them.
Hey, what's going on? This is Ricardo with the Code 7 Podcast Network, and this is going to be episode 290 of Within the Trenches, true stories from the 911 dispatchers who live them. This episode is supported by InDigital, leader next-gen core services, and I am recording live from the 2019 TINA conference, and we are currently in the vendor hall. This is the last day for the vendor hall. We're here from about 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central, and then there's sessions going on all throughout the afternoon, and then the big banquet is going on at the end in the evening, where they'll be giving out awards and all types of other things. So it's going to be a good time, and I am very excited to be here and to have my guest. And her name is Leslie, and she is a QA training coordinator with Carter County ECD. How's it going?
It's good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I am doing very well. So you've been here since Sunday, right? So
yes.
From the beginning. What are a couple things, I guess, that you have enjoyed, throughout this time and in some of the sessions, and what you kind of plan on taking back?
I love the vendor hall. I've been here a couple times already. We have GeoConnects as our CAD vendor, and mm-hmm. we just went through an upgrade with them. So we've actually brought back a couple of our concerns from the comm center, like that their issues that they're having right now, mm-hmm. and they've fixed them while we've been here. So it's been great to just,
That's pretty awesome.
Get all that, taken care of.
Yeah.
And they've got their staff, even talking to ours right now, we're just tweaking little things that we've got going on. But I love the classes. Yesterday I went to one of Paul Cash's leadership classes, going to a couple more of those this afternoon, and then looking forward to the class this afternoon on, I think next I'm going to a school safety one and then an active shooter one this afternoon to look forward to. So that's what I want to take back.
That is all very good information and everything to be able to take back, especially for, school type incidents or active shooter incidents. But how crazy is it that that's something that we're now preparing for? It's almost normal,
I know.
And there was something that I saw, I don't know if it's real or not, but I saw it on Facebook. Somebody had shared an advertisement for a bulletproof backpack, and it gives me goosebumps just talking about it. But I thought, damn, that is what the normal is. Like, it's just crazy to think that that's some stuff, but it's also good stuff, in a sense, for sessions and training for you guys to know.
Yeah.
And having to deal with that.
Yeah. We've done some trainings and stuff on it, and until this year, I guess it kind of really hit home a lot more. My son is 5 and he just went into kindergarten. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of takes a more personal level like this year.
Of course.
And we've got an SRO at the school this year with him and stuff. And every day the officer gets him out of the car, opens the door, and, he says, "Hi, Officer Kenny." And, they know him on a first name basis. It's just sad that it's normal now.
Right.
But we want to be prepared for it. It's
exactly.
Probably my biggest nightmare. I mean, we've taken a lot of really bad calls, but an active shooter is my biggest nightmare.
Yeah, and so I have an episode that I recorded about a year and a half ago, I think now, and it was with Marshall County out of Kentucky, and a couple of their dispatchers worked an active shooter situation with the school. One of the dispatchers that I was talking with, her daughter had been sick, and so she wasn't sure if she was going to school that day. So, and she worked the morning shift, so she left before, any of the kids went to school or anything. So while all of this is going on, she has no idea if her daughter is there or not. And, oh man, just listening to them talk about that to her talk about it, it was gut-wrenching. And luckily, her daughter didn't feel well enough, and she ended up staying home. So she had been home the whole time, but it was so busy there that she didn't have a chance to try to, see if she was home or anything else.
Yeah, because you got to keep going on with the call and the
exactly.
radio, and, until you can get a break to, because it's not like you can be like, oh, hold on 1 minute, I need to go text my family. Mm-hmm. And that's,
right.
So we're taking care of other people before we take care of our own. And that's just... it's gut-wrenching to me that we might have to deal with this one day in our county, but and that's why we prepare for it.
Exactly. You know? That's why you prepare, for sure. Now, I want to go back in time a little bit, and I want to learn more about yourself. How did you get into dispatching to begin with? Did you have family or friends or anything like that that was in law enforcement, or you just kind of jumped in or fell into it?
Like 90% of the other dispatchers, I just fell into it. I mean, I know like, I've listened to a lot of your podcasts, and like a lot of them are just like, no, you know, I mean, I just got a job offer. So I graduated from Milligan College in 2003, immediate, and I had a communications degree. So I went into journalism, and I was a newspaper reporter and then a newspaper editor for about 5 or 6 years. Then I kind of wanted to go back to school. But the school hours and, you know, classes and all that stuff wouldn't really work with my job. And it just so happened that there was some dispatch openings coming up, and part of my beat for the newspaper was with the sheriff's department and the police and all that stuff. So that's kind of how I got into knowing them, and the sheriff offered me a job, and I took it. And I spent about 2 years there and then transferred to Carter County, and I've been there for almost 10. And
oh, wow.
It. Yeah.
So, okay, so I've got a couple of questions now thinking about this. Okay, so you're coming from the media.
Yes, yes.
And so was there
I was on the evil side.
I was going to say, yeah. was there ever any time while you were in that position, you know, as a journalist, that you called into dispatch to, you know, because you always got somebody that's coming, or whenever something happens, they call up and they'll say, hey, are you working this? Are you working this? And like, well, it's kind of obvious that you heard it. So did you have to do that as well?
I'm sure that I probably did, but in some ways we had a really great sheriff who loved the media. Okay. So, and this is going to sound weird, but I swear to you, he actually would call me like on some major things. Like they had a murder that was up on the mountain, and he literally called me and said, hey, we're going up to, you know, this spot on the mountain, you know, they're going to recover the body in a minute. Have you heard about it? And I was like, no, I haven't. And he's like, get in the car. I'll be out in the front of the office.
Damn.
And, like, literally picked me up. So, I mean,
that's awesome.
Yeah. I mean,
that is a good relationship to have with the media.
Though. It is, yeah. This is probably all wrong, but I mean, like I would literally, if I heard something on the scanner, I would listen to it for a few minutes and either go out to the scene. I didn't try to call in there because I knew that I shouldn't, but sometimes if I needed more information about what was going on, I would literally walk across the street because that's where the jail and the sheriff's department was. I would walk across the street and go in there into dispatch, and they would let me in. And
dang.
I know. I mean, now that I know what I know on the 911 side, I'm like, what in the world were they doing?
Right.
But so I would go in there, just get a little bit more information. They'd be like, here's the address, you know, and I'm like, okay, thanks. You know.
So oh, man.
They were very media friendly and very open about it over there, even though they probably shouldn't have been. So.
Right. Well, okay. So then you make that transition over, and then what was it like for you when you transitioned over and then getting those calls from the media? Like, were you, especially when crazy stuff was going on, I mean, you've always got a moment where somebody's calling in, you're like, man, I don't have any information for you right now, but, you know, call back later, or here's the sergeant's phone number, or something like that.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can get short with people. So did you have those moments, or did you completely understand and you were able to balance it out a little bit more?
I try to balance it out.
Yeah,
but there were times, you know, where it was really busy or something. It's like, call the sheriff, call the chief or something like that. We are not, you know, we cannot give you that information. But I also have, I guess, the sympathy of it because I know what their job is.
Right.
So they're just trying to do a job just like how we are. They don't want to bother us. It's not like that, you know, I mean, but they need the information too. So if it's calmed down a little bit, I'll give them what I can.
Gotcha.
You know, so we were, and I try to pass that along to my other dispatchers because they don't understand it. You know, they're just like, oh, the media is calling in again, blah, 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 blah. But there's some of them that they really just, you know, they just need that information too because they want to get that story out there.
Right.
And, you know, it's not that they're not trying to take advantage or anything like that. They don't mean it to be like, you know, well, I'm just going to call 911 and get this information. I mean,
they're
just trying to get what they need to. So
yeah.
I'm actually very sympathetic to them. I mean, I don't know if you heard about the plane crash that was a few weeks ago with Dale Earnhardt Jr.
Oh, yes.
That's our town.
No way.
Yeah, that was our county. So
holy crap.
Yeah.
I mean, Okay. Well, yeah. There's another one. Yeah.
Just write that question down. You can ask about it later.
Yeah. we'll jump into that as well. So going back around, though, so you get into dispatching. That's how you get started and all. I mean, what's your training like? You know, you've got this transition where you're coming from being a journalist, and now you're sitting in front of however many screens, and you're starting to take phone calls, and yeah. You're really getting into the thick of it. And what was that like for you?
I don't want to bash the first agency that I worked for, but their training was a sink or swim kind of thing. You know, I had about like a week or so of like sitting with someone and them showing me a few things and then just like get on the console. And that's, now that I'm over training, that is absolutely 100% not the way that we do it. So once I trained there and then went over to my new agency, I mean, it took me, I was probably in training for a few months because I was part-time. And then when full-time position came up, I was ready to go full-time. So I was kind of like training, but, you know, still working a little bit too and just learning the geography, but mostly the system was still the same. So
gotcha.
Yeah, so it didn't take too long. But now our agency, we do a 2-week in the classroom training, and then we put them out with their CTOs on the floor. They do some observation, and then they start taking phone calls, and then start with city police, and then, you know, go from there. So
nice.
And it takes anywhere from 6 months to a year to train.
Dang.
Yeah.
You know, I always say dang when people say, you know, 6 months to a year in their training. But I have to think back that when I was doing my training and stuff in the dispatch center that I was at, the most recent one, the last one, I had 3.5 years already of dispatch experience coming into it. So mine was only about 3 months. So I always forget, you know, in comparison, a lot of people don't have that experience coming in. So you're going through all of your training. Do you remember your first call at all?
No.
Or any of your early calls?
I remember some early ones, but I mean, no, I don't remember the first one at all. Like I have the worst memory ever, like, as far as...
A lot of us do, right?
Yeah, and I guess it's useful in this position, too, because, I mean, like, there's a lot of bad calls that, I mean, I can just kind of forget about. But when someone brings them up, I'm like, oh, yeah, that was horrible, you know?
Right, it does come back. Once someone talks about it, it's kind of, for lack of a better term, a trigger.
A trigger, you know?
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
It brings it back. Mm-hmm. So... Throughout your career in the beginning, so how long have you been a training coordinator?
I just started this in the end of April, 1st of May kind of thing. I actually got the job and then went on vacation the next day.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, so I kind of came back in May and actually started doing the job.
That's kind of awesome that you get a promotion and I'm like, hey, later, deuces, I'm going to go take a vacation.
It really was. I mean, like my supervisor on my shift was like, he was planning for me to go on vacation anyways and stuff. And I was like, oh, yeah, and by the way, I won't be back. I'm going to the office. He's like... Man.
So then what was it, I guess, that really, you know, and this can be from the beginning of your time in dispatch to the moment that you want to be a training coordinator. What was it that really solidified, one, that this job was a job for you, and two, that you wanted to move further in your career by being a training coordinator and training more people coming in?
I don't know if there's one moment. I mean, I kind of think of it as like, I tell some people it's kind of like an addiction. Like that, you know, that high that you get when the officers say they're 10-15, you know, or one in custody. You know, I always forget our codes are different. But that high that you get when they catch somebody, or that high that you get when you get a save or you get a really good call or you get paramedics there before, you know, the worst happens.
Right.
And you give them that extra chance. So I think it's like that high from that like I'm addicted to. Like, and I think everybody's like that. So I don't know that if it was one call in particular. I mean, there are several that I remember, you know, I mean, as far as like the worst calls where it's like, I really want to quit. Like, I don't want to do this anymore.
Right. Yeah.
But it's like you come back another day and, you know, and then you get another good call or you get a pursuit and, you know, they get the guy and you're the girl or whatever. And it's like, you know.
Right. Exactly.
You know,
it brings
you're cheering,
you right
you're like, yes.
back. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It brings you back and you're like, this is what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
This is what it is here.
Yeah.
So then what about the training then?
The training, I mean, when that position opened up, I said it's perfect for me. I told my boss, I was like, you have to hire me. Like, I'm sorry, but you do. I'm going to be great at it.
Nice.
They're going to listen confidence. Back to this and be like, wow, Leslie, great.
Confidence is good, though.
But no, I mean, I've always loved education. I mean, if I could go back to school right now, I would, like, just to learn different stuff and not to even really change my career, just to, because I love to sit in on classes, and that's why I love coming to conferences and stuff. I mean,
right.
Going to, whether it's, you know, something for leadership, which I'm trying to learn more about now, to like the technical stuff, like cybersecurity. I don't know a thing about that, those kind of things. So my IT guy, he tries to explain things, and I'm like, yeah. What are you saying?
Right,
you
know? Yeah. But I need to learn more about that. Ones and zeros. Like, yeah. I don't know what you're saying.
Yeah. And so I need to learn more about that so I can have conversations with him. That's,
right.
And, you know, so, I mean, I just like to learn things, and I want to pass that along to other people. And if I can give them the same kind of opportunities to get them to come to conferences or to bring people to them to talk, I think it just re-energizes you when you get to do things like this and get out of the seat and the console, because you're stuck there for 12 hours at a time, or, you know, 8 hours, whatever your shift is, and it's, you don't even see the light of day half the time.
Right,
but
of course.
These kind of things re-energize you and give you that, like, oh man, I'm ready to go back. I'm ready to do this again. You know, I'm ready to take that bad call, that worst call. So, I know that I remember I had some domestic violence training early on, like probably a year or two in, and that one was when I came away with, like, I learned so much at it that I still carry it to today. And, you know, I'm very, I guess, sympathetic a lot more, and, like, learned more about, like, you know, how many times it takes someone to get away, and, you know, the victim mentality of it all, and, like, how mentally they're just abused mentally,
right,
beaten down. So I guess I kind of want the other new dispatchers who didn't get a chance to take that class to get to take another one, you know. So
and in this sense, when you were coming to stuff like this too, it's almost like a train the trainer type thing, because you're getting all this information and stuff, and you can take it back and you can continue to put it that way. You know, you can make up your own booklets or anything, you know, tips and tricks for them to work on that. And that,
yeah,
that is a really good thing.
Yeah. And when I was doing a certified training officer, a CTO or whatever, I was actually on the floor, and I would have new trainees with me, and I tried to explain things in a way that, think about it from the officer's point of view, or think about it from whoever's responding point of view, or the caller's point of view, and try to put it in that way instead of, no, this is just what we do because our policy says it.
Right.
You need to know why we do this and what this person is thinking. And instead of, man, this same family called for the fifth time today or whatever, they're still fighting. I mean, yeah, it gets aggravating. But to understand that victim mentality of it, of the constant going back and forth, and they apologize and you go back again, and then, you know, something happens again. I mean, so you can't get complacent to it, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Now, understanding is definitely key in a lot of the things that happen. So what about a call that has stuck with you?
I was thinking during your session the other night, I didn't tell this one at your the Imagine Listening, mm-hmm, whenever we saw you down in Nina. I didn't tell this one, and I don't know why that it didn't come up then, but in your session the other night, this one just came to my mind, and I kind of forgot about it for years, I guess. I kind of pushed it back, but one of the worst ones was a guy called, and he was, you know how you get a call and they're just calm? It's like, you know, you're thinking, oh, someone's hit their mailbox. This is no big deal. You know, he gives me his address, he gives me his phone number, repeats it back, or verifies it. And then I says, okay, tell me exactly what happened. He said, my name is blah, blah, blah. I'm going to kill myself. And, you know, you take suicidal calls all the time, or people who are threatening. That one moment, I knew he was serious. Like, I mean, it wasn't like, oh, this is somebody else who's just threatening and wants, you know, needs to go to the hospital. I knew immediately that he was serious. And he even said, before he told me his name, and like he said, my name is, he told me what his house looked like. And I remember he said, it has a red roof. And he said, and then he said, I'm going to kill myself. And I knew right then that he was going to do it. And I said, okay, tell me how you're going to... I was just trying to keep him on the line. I was just trying to ask him questions. And everybody else in the room was listening in. They're getting everybody on the way and stuff. And
right.
So thank goodness for great coworkers. I mean, because I know that they do that. So I didn't even have to, like, you know, be like, hey, get me help.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah. Active listening.
Yeah, so they were getting everybody in route. And I tried asking him maybe one or two more questions. And he disconnected. And then I called him back probably 12 times. I mean, I was just like, ring back. And it kept going to voicemail. And I kept talking to his voicemail. And I was, you know, this is Leslie at 911. I need you to pick up the phone. Come on. Just trying to get something for him to pick up the phone.
Right.
I knew he'd already done it. And then afterwards, I got to thinking, his family's going to come home and they're going to listen to those voicemails. And I felt so bad. But I knew, like, I thought maybe if he hears one of these voicemails before he does it, maybe he'll pick up and maybe right. I can get someone there to him. The officers were there within 3 minutes and he had already done it. But, I mean, it was just,
jeez.
There was nothing we could have done. You know, he was determined.
But. Right. No, it's, and I can fully relate with you. There's a story on that video that I played where it says, I called you the day that you committed suicide by running your car into a tree.
Yeah.
That's my call. That's one of my calls. The last 2 weeks actually of my dispatch career, excuse me, it was almost as if the dispatch gods wanted to throw everything at me. And one of the calls was a disorderly subject who had come into this house. The girl called and they knew this guy and they said he just came in and I had put it in as a disorderly because of the way they were talking about it. He wasn't there anymore. He had just left and we were going to send someone out to talk to them and then search the area for him. But at the very end of the call, she says, you know, he's probably suicidal. And I said, what? And she goes, well, he was suicidal before. And I mean, he might still be. I'm like, why didn't you say that in the beginning? And I said, you know, do you have a phone number for him? And I had the phone number already. I just wanted to reconfirm that I had the right one. So I got it, hung up with her. And I started calling him right away to try to get a hold of him as we had people going out there. And then the phone just kept ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing. And I had another person on phones with me, but he was so busy because it was that shift change that nobody else could pick up the phone. And I thought, well, I'm trying to call this guy. I need to hang up and just pick up the phone. And I pick up the phone and there's a guy who says, you know, this I just saw a car run into a tree. And I said, where are you? And he told me the location, and it was just down the road from that house. I thought, son of a bitch. And I yelled over to my partner on radios, and I said, I think this is my guy. And I had the vehicle description, and I said, can you tell me what kind of car it is? Can you safely go over and check on this person to see if he or she is okay? And he goes, it's a guy. I don't think there's any way he lived through that, but I'll go check. And he goes, no, I don't think he's with us. I can't do anything with him. He goes, but it's a blue Toyota Tercel. And I thought, that's my guy. And then they got out there and they confirmed it. And like you, you know, how you were saying that you had left those voicemails and that really stuck with you. You know, you felt bad. I took like 20 minutes or more after the call, looking at the map and mapping out the distance and trying to play it back in my head and thinking, would it have worked at all if I had any other line of questioning that I could have gotten that information faster? Or what if I would have gotten a hold of him? Was the phone ringing while he was already gone? You know, and I finally got to the point where I realized there was no way I was going to get to him. Like you, there was nothing you could do, nothing at all. But it's those types of calls that really stick with you.
We just had one recently like that, that a lady, she was having a panic attack or anxiety attack. And I can't remember all the details about it because I wasn't actually in the comm center. I came in there to help whenever it was all going on.
Right.
But it was like, we got a call from a family member, said that she was having this anxiety attack. They were trying to find her, thought she was in our county, but she actually ended up being in the neighboring county. We were trying to call her phone, and she apparently was talking to somebody. At one point, she called the friend who then called us, and they had two phones, and so we could hear her on the phone, and she was saying, I'm passing this or whatever, but she really, like, but we couldn't figure out where it was. It was nothing that, you know, you could, you know, get a location off of. And it ended up our dispatcher heard her start screaming, and the other girl was trying to talk to her and saying, you know, tell me where you are, tell me where you are. And she was screaming, and we just thought she was part of the anxiety attack because she had actually been screaming a little bit before that.
Right.
And, turns out that that screaming, she had two kids with her in the car, that screaming was when she ran off the road and hit a tree and caught on fire. Our dispatcher actually heard them all die. We didn't know it until after the fact, like 30 or 45 minutes later, when the other agency was calling us because we were all working it together. And they called us and they said, what time did you all get that call? And, you know, and then they got the call like a minute, you know, just a couple seconds later of that vehicle wreck. And we all pieced it together and, you know.
Oh, man.
But those are the sounds that stick with you. You know what I mean?
Right, exactly.
I don't remember their names, but I know the sounds, you know. I mean, I remember the sounds.
That's, yeah, and that's what, you know, the movement and everything is all about, you know, these stories that stick with us, but also sharing them and getting them out there and in some weird way gaining a form of closure and kind of healing in a way as well, because, you know, you know you're not alone.
Yeah, and I mean, when we attended your session down in Nina in Orlando, I mean, it was the girl that was with me, Alora. Shout out, Alora! Woo!
Yeah.
she shared a story of a drowning that she had, and so when you were talking in your session the other night, you know, about the one that you took about the woman who found her kid, but then they were able to save her,
right?
Or
yes.
Save the child. We weren't that lucky, and Alora had taken that call, and I was actually in comm center with Alora that day. This is actually before I switched over to admin side, and she took that call. She might have been with us maybe less than 6 months. She was new to us, but she had experience and fully trained, and she took that call, and afterwards I told her, I said, there was nothing more you could have done. That mom, when she saw him, she just started screaming, and she went to like level 5, and like there was no cooperation then. I mean, we had all of our people in route, but when she went out there and actually found him in the ice and the pond and stuff, I mean, it was, you couldn't get her back. And those screams are, you know, it's forever burned in your mind kind of thing.
It's great though that the both of you were there in that session, and she was able to share that, and she had you there with her. So that's very cool. Yeah. You guys have, I tell people all the time, you know, in dispatch, it's like a second family. You know,
yeah.
We see everybody else more than we see our own family, and the camaraderie's there.
Yeah. And I think that because of that relationship, you can kind of see when there's something going on with somebody, whether it's in their personal life or, you know, in comm center life, like that. What's going on? Like, why are you so stressed? Why are you getting so angry right now? And, it, you know, whether it's been a call that you just don't know about on the admin side of things or so I guess, you know, you can kind of intervene a little bit more. That's something that we're wanting to get started more, like the peer support and more mental health awareness, I guess.
Right.
We do have a quiet room. We do tell our people, like, I mean, get out, take a break, you know, after something like that. But
see, and that's awesome because there are some places that you don't get to do that at all. Yeah. Even, you know, some places don't have a quiet room. Some places don't. They just, you got to move on to the next one.
Yeah. We're at a short level for staff right now. So, I mean, as soon as we get some of our people trained again, I mean, it'll be a little bit easier. But, yeah, you know how it is. I mean, you're short-staffed. You just got to pick up the next phone call. You can't
right.
get away.
Yeah. And on the kind of the lighter side of it as well, especially when you're eating. and you've got, you know, you've got that squirrel mode where all the food is stuck on the side of your mouth. And you move on to the next call and you're like, shit, well, what am I going to do now? There's nothing I can do. It's got to stay there.
Yeah. So you just kind of keep chewing in the middle. Like you mute the phone, just keep chewing.
Exactly.
Tell me your really long story now, because
yeah.
I have time for it.
Yep.
I want to take some more bites.
I would do the same thing. As they're talking, I would mute it, or because I would wear a headset sometimes, I would move the mouthpiece up and then just start eating and stuff. Like, you still there? I'm like, yeah, I'm still here. I'm just listening to everything that you're saying.
Like, hello, I can't hear you. Oh, yeah, hold on.
Yeah, whoops. Why do you
here?
Sound so far away? I'm like, I don't want you to hear me chewing. That's
what's
why.
What's that crunching noise? Background stuff.
Right. It's the static in the phone. Okay. Yeah. That's the Rice Krispies.
It's background.
So, out of everything that you've been that you've done and all, and we kind of mentioned this in the beginning, a few weeks ago, there was a. Now, it was a smaller plane, right?
Yeah. It's
Because I remember just seeing it like on breaking news on like Facebook and then on Twitter and stuff. I was like, what? Who crashed?
Yeah.
And then I saw the name. I thought, I wonder if I know anyone who's working that area. And lo and behold, I do.
Yeah. Yep, that's us.
So, I mean, how did that, I mean, I was going to say, how did that come in? Obviously, it came in through 911. But, I mean, I can just imagine wherever, where it happened. And the amount of phone calls that were coming in.
Yeah.
I guess.
It was kind of nuts.
Kind of take me through it a little bit.
I wasn't there. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
I was on my day off. I had a day off and my mom texted me. She's like, you got a plane crash? I was like, what? And she saw it on Facebook.
Yeah.
And I said, what are you talking about? And I texted the supervisor and like Ollie, I can't remember what he said, but he said something like, yes, you know, like long drawn out. And I was like, oh crap. So I run out of the house. My husband has just gotten home and I was like, I gotta go. There's a plane crash. So, and I went in to help them out a little bit or whatever. But, you know, by then it was already the most already done. But so from what I gather that happened, and we've got a debriefing kind of thing with all the agencies here coming up soon. So, but from what happened on our side of things, one of our trainees who's actually here at the conference right now, she had been on phones less than 2 weeks. And so Laura, the girl that you met, she was actually her CTO and was sitting beside of her and everything. And, you know, Angie takes the first call and it's Carter County 911. What's the address of your emergency? And the guy says something about a plane crash, you know, like that. And it's I think he says roll everything you got, you know. So Alora, like Angie, just rolls her chair back, and Alora just rolls right in. And if you don't, if you listen to the recording, you don't even hear it. You don't even hear the seamless because they're both on headsets, and Alora takes over.
Yeah.
And so most people, because they're both females, they don't even know it's two different people. But so anyways, they start taking the calls, and it's nuts. I mean, I think they got several different calls on it. The plane went off the runway and into Highway 91, which is a five lane highway.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we had all kinds of people calling. We actually had an officer that before we ever got it dispatched to the officer's channel, he rolls up. He's like, comm center, I think we have a plane crash on Highway 91. And they're like, 10-4, getting the phone calls right now.
Right. You got to be really
10-4,
fast.
You're on team.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
thanks for telling us. We know. They dispatched out fire, medical, all that stuff. And luckily, there were no serious injuries, as you know. Dale Earnhardt Jr. was fine. Thank goodness. His wife, his child, and he had his dog on board. And I'll tell you a funny story about that in a minute. And then there's two pilots on board. They were extremely, extremely lucky. I mean, but when you see there's a video that someone has from across the street of it, and they actually come out of the plane, they actually went through a fence, a chain link fence, the plane did, and it wrapped around the plane. But on that part of the fuselage where the door was, it didn't get to that part. Otherwise, they would have been trapped inside.
Jeez.
Yeah. So it's, and you can see them coming out of the plane. And if you look closely, you can see where that fence is wrapped around it. And I mean, it's just luck, God, you know, everything on their side that they were able to get out. And the plane, the back end's on fire, and then the fire's coming up to the front. I mean, it's one of those things you see in a movie, and you know.
Yeah, exactly. I'm imagining all of it as you're describing it, and I'm thinking, man, yeah, this is definitely in a movie where, you know, somebody is taken off, and that's all that happens.
Yeah, I mean, they were landing is how it happened. They landed, and you know, I don't know the technical things of what all has happened. The NTSB, I don't know if they've really released the report of exactly how it happened, but for whatever reason, something about like the landing gear failed at the end, that they tried to land a couple times, and then and then they just went off the runway. So
jeez,
don't take that as the official account, whoever's listening.
Right, yeah. Research your own stuff.
Yeah. Listen to the FAA.
There you go.
But that's my horrible rendition of what happened.
Oh, man.
But, Gus, let me tell you a funny story. So, but we didn't know, like, for about an hour and a half that it was Dale Earnhardt Jr.
Oh,
it was already on Facebook that it was Dale Earnhardt Jr.,
but
we didn't know it. So, one of our rescue, what's his name? I can't remember his title, but Anthony Roberts is his name.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, he he heard the fire department tone out and everything, and so he was part of our EMS agency, which is a different channel for us. So he starts getting in route, you know, as we're dispatching out fire as well, and then once we finally dispatch out rescue, he's already in his truck and going. Their station is literally like 30 seconds away.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so, I mean, he was right there.
Perfect.
So by the time that our dispatcher is done dispatching on the rescue channel, like 20-some seconds, he's like, 10-4, I'm on scene. So he was right there on scene, you know. Very good response time.
Yeah.
But anyways, he gets there, he checks them out, you know, I mean, realizes that there's not any major injuries from what I can, you know, what I've heard. But ambulances come and check them all out, and they take Dale Earnhardt Jr. to the hospital. But while he's there talking to them, Dale Earnhardt, like, tells him, he says, man, can you find my dog? And he looks around, and, like, he's like, this dog? And, like, points over, and he's like, yeah. So he's like, can you take care of my dog, you know? And he's like, yeah. So he goes, and he gets in his rescue truck, and he finds, like, a rope or something like that.
Yeah.
Leads the dog over to the rescue truck and turns the air on and all that stuff, and he leaves it in there so that it can't, you know, get out and run around. And so he said that he's, they talk a little bit, and he's like, yeah, my dog's name's Gus and everything. He's like, no way, my dog's name's Gus too, you know, I mean, just kind of, you know,
cool.
Talking with his patient, trying to keep him calm and all that while the ambulance is getting ready to take him. And so this goes on, and he checks everybody else out, the pilots and all this other stuff, and Gus is just hanging out in the truck. Well, then some powers that be come, and they're like, who released the name? The publicist of Dale Earnhardt Jr. is like, or the publicist is saying, who released the name? It's already in the media. And he's like, whose name? And he's like, the guy over there, the guy in the plane crash. Who released his name? He's like, the only name I know is Gus. He's like, I don't even know who this is. He said, I've talked to him for 30 minutes. I never even realized it was Dale Earnhardt Jr. He said, all I knew was, hey, yeah, I'm taking care of your dog Gus back here.
Right. That's funny stuff. Yeah.
So for all of us, even like the ones on scene treating him, we're like, you're
right.
Who? You
know? Yeah. It was probably just some passerby who was like, oh man, check out who it is.
Yeah.
The publicist is coming after you guys. We're like, we don't even know his name. We're trying to treat him and help his dog.
We didn't even write his name down. I swear, you know, I mean, they were like, you know, it's in the heat of the moment. They were
right.
Like,
of course.
Like, you're who?
Dang.
We're very observant.
Yeah. Oh man, that is awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that story and for being on this episode. This has been a lot of fun. Going into the wrap up of this episode, for people who are thinking of coming to a conference, national conference, state conference, or especially this one, Tina, you know, what is, I guess, some thoughts or advice that you have for them if those are, you know, kind of on the fence for maybe going to it?
I would say go. I mean,
like to be a guest on the show, send an email to WTTpodcast@gmail.com.